The Jazz Scene Podcast gives an in-depth look at the lives and stories of the musicians performing in Columbus and beyond. Today's episode is hosted by Alex Burgoyne, Director of Production for the Jazz Arts Group of Columbus.
Hi and welcome. This is the Jazz Scene Podcast. We're here with Helen Song. Welcome, Helen.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thanks for being here, yeah. You're performing with your band, and you're performing music from the album Quartet Plus with a quartet from Columbus. What's it like to tour with a band and then add on strings later? Yeah.
It's actually a lot of fun. When I first put the project together, I knew, you know, bringing 8 people on the road probably wasn't going to be very practical, but I thought the project lent itself to collaborating with the community that I would be performing in. So it's Quartet Plus pairs my jazz quartet with a string quartet. So I've gotten to do this at several places out in the Bay Area, at Amherst College, at University of Wisconsin-Madison in Poland, of all places. Wow. It was so exciting. And so now I get to be here in Columbus, Ohio with your own Chamber Brews string quartet.
Very good. Is it stressful, like, to not really know what you're getting until you get there?
No.
Yeah, amazing.
I think, you know, musicians, we say traveling is the real stress, because
yeah,
it's
sure.
just, especially now as airplanes get smaller and smaller. I swear the other day I was on the plane with the smallest bathroom ever. Like, I couldn't find the toilet paper. I was like, where is it? And finally the rolls were like practically near the floor. So that is the real stress. And just meeting new musicians, of course, you know, how are we going to mesh musically? That maybe is just, it's more like, let's see what's going to happen.
Because fun,
yeah. Yeah, most everywhere, it's just, you know, fabulous musicians, and we just find a way to work together. And every time, you know, when you work with a new group, is a little different, and so that keeps us on our toes.
Yeah,
and it's fresh and exciting.
That's cool. That's amazing. You have a lot of collaborative projects. You collaborate a lot with poets, or a couple times at least. Do you have a favorite way to start those projects? Do you have a starting place for yourself?
For me, I find the best collaborations started organically. And like the collaboration with the poet Dana Gioia, who was chairman of the National Endowment for 2 terms, and also state of California, where he's from, the state poet laureate. I met him at all places, of all places, at the White House when he was chairman of the NEA, and I just happened to be seated next to him at a state dinner. We were about to perform for the In Performance at the White House PBS series.
Sure.
And he was the first living poet I'd ever met. And, you know, I'm also a huge science fiction fan. Mm-hmm. And I was thrilled to find out he knew both Ray Bradbury and Orson Scott Card, two of my favorite
cool.
authors. And then, you know, I felt like I had to admit to him. I said, well, you know, I don't really enjoy reading poetry. And he asked me why. And I said, well, I just feel like I'm always the person in the room that doesn't understand what's going on. He said, well, don't worry so much about literal meaning. Like, poetry is meant to be experienced like music, out loud, and the meaning will come at you sideways. And that got me reading poetry again. And really, I actually enjoy when the meaning's kind of ambiguous, because I think that's the beauty of poetry. It meets each person where they are. So, you know, we became friends and we exchanged works. Like, he would send me books of his poetry and I would send him whatever CD I was working on or had just released. And finally he said, you know, let's make an album together, write some songs together. And then with the string quartet, I just, I play the violin too as a young kid.
Okay,
I started out classical piano violin, always wanted to write for string quartets. And during the pandemic, I had just gotten this grant to create a CD of music all by women. And I said, let me do it. This is it. So yeah, I just feel really grateful, because getting to do collaborations like this is really, it's every artist's dream. And I just finished recording my big band album last week. I'm glad I've survived and here to tell the story. So yeah, looking forward to more, and especially tomorrow with Chamber Brews.
Yeah, amazing. you mentioned growing up, you grew up in Houston, right? Violin and piano. Was there anything else tickling your fancy at the time?
Well, I tried several instruments. I tried flute, but I almost passed out. So I was like, maybe this is not the right instrument. That you have to have so much air when you blow through the flute, as my saxophone player tells me all the time. You'll hear him play flute tomorrow.
He sounds great, by the way, on the record.
Yes, yeah. He does. John Ellis. Piano and violin. I was into spelling bee. I did that. And a little league softball. I wasn't so great at that, but it was fun. But music-wise, it was classical, piano, violin, both starting at age 5. And just a very classical upbringing. I went to that Performing Arts High School in Houston, HSPVA, where so many of the great jazz artists are from, which is pretty amazing. You know, people like Jason Moran, Robert Glasper, Eric Harlan, and the list just goes on and on. But I was classical back then, so.
Must have infected you somehow.
I guess, you know, to be honest, when I think back, I think I was intimidated by the jazzers because I didn't know how do you make music without any music on the page. So I think I was almost done with my undergraduate degree in classical piano performance at UT Austin that I was finally ready brave enough to let it impact me. And it came, oddly enough, my friend had a huge crush on Harry Connick Jr. And
sure, who doesn't, you know?
I didn't really know he was. I was just like a very dutiful, nerdy classical major,
sure.
Always in the practice room, and she dragged me to his show. And he had his big band with him, and they were very entertaining. But in the middle of the show, he sat down and played some solo piano, and I remember feeling like I'd been struck by lightning, like, I didn't know you were allowed to play the piano like that. And just, I need to find out more about this. And that just started me on this journey, this adventure that continues on today.
It is shocking to me to hear you say that. Like, my assumption was that you grew up in a family listening to Winton Records or something. I don't know, you know?
Well, unfortunately, no. You know, my parents are immigrants in China via Taiwan, and very practical, and didn't come from musical households. And so the only music I really heard, like, intentionally growing up was what the piano teacher would tell my parents to check to provide for us. And but I did watch Sesame Street and Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, and I loved Charlie Brown, so I did hear some jazz.
Sure.
So it was a huge life change, and it was, you know, it was really very much like starting over again, but I'm
sure.
So glad I just really persevered, because it wasn't easy.
It's nice to start over in a place where you're, like, you have chops out the wazoo, and you can just learn. That's cool.
Well, my first jazz teacher at UT Austin was very wise. He knew that the notes were not going to be a problem, but mm-hmm. the feeling. And then, of course, learning how to improvise. You know, swing, that's the heartbeat of jazz. And that's something I'll be working on forever.
Yeah, sure. All of us. So you heard Harry Connick. I've been curious, like, what are the other things that, like, hit you right away?
Well, I went to the UT Music Library. I didn't know anything about jazz, and so checked out some books, and luckily they were good books. One was Meet Me at Jim and Andy's by Gene Lees, and the other one was Conversations with a Great Pianist by Lynn Lyons. So I just started listening to recordings. The UT jazz piano professor, he was really into Bill Evans, so I listened to... That was a really good gateway pianist, you know, because such a beautiful, nuanced way to play. And I remember feeling so, like, mystified by Monk.
Oh, sure.
And Kenny Wheeler was, like, everybody loved him at UT Austin. So I really really enjoyed listening to his music. And then when I was lucky enough to get into the Thelonious Monk Institute of Jazz Performance, which took me to Boston because it was at NEC, New England Conservatory of Music, that just, you know, to get to work with people like Clark Terry and Jimmy Heath and Jackie McLean and Ron Carter and Barry Harris. I mean, the list just goes on and on. That's like the history of jazz right there.
You know, I was telling my producer, like, it's I'm having a hard time imagining encountering your jazz heroes, kind of. And what's it like to play with Clark Terry?
Oh, just, well, it's
did it freak
remarkable.
You out?
Yeah, well, not only that, he gave me my first serious thrashing on stage and public humiliation. I mean, not on purpose, just, you know, that was like kind of a rite of passage, I think, for a lot of jazz musicians, like Charlie Parker famously, Papa Jeff Jones threw the cymbal at him and stop playing. You know, I kind of had a similar experience with Clark and just feeling like, oh my God, can I just sink into the floor, never to be seen from again? But, you know, one thing I really appreciated about that generation, we call them the jazz masters, that, you know, they were there creating this music in real time during history. So it was very personal for them. They literally risked their lives to play this music. He would tell us stories of when they would be down south and performing, then had to run for their lives after the concerts, you know, and just the fact that that kind of just really, to me, traumatizing kind of experience. Like, but then he would tell me a story once where a guy came up and just literally hit him with it was like a police baton with a whip at the end, with those sharp shards of metal, and knocked him out. And then he went and got his buddies. They were going to come kill him, but then this other guy hid him in the back of his car. And so he says, that's why I cannot hate anybody. You know, I cannot judge any, you know, race by just one or two bad actors or whatever in that situation. So just so inspiring that, you know, this music, they took it so seriously that they didn't mind. Well, they loved the music and loved us enough to hurt our feelings and tell us the truth and make us cry a little bit sometimes, just because they wanted us to get it. They were entrusting something very precious to us, and they didn't just share technical info. They shared their lives too. You know, they spent time with us. They bought us lunch, dinner. They told us stories. So it was just, they shared their lives with us, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an amazing thing. Jazz is kind of like that. Yeah, it's very cool. Mm-hmm. You've had some big moments in your career after NEC. Talk about some of the prizes you've won for composition. Like, you know, I don't want to name them all, but you probably have a favorite experience.
Well, I mean, made my debut at Carnegie Hall in October of 22 with Quartet Plus. That was exciting. Like, wow. I was lucky enough to get a Guggenheim Fellowship, which enabled me to do this big band project, which is, I'm calling it, this is kind of silly, but one of my favorite stores ever was Bed Bath & Beyond. Did you have that here?
Yeah, sure.
I didn't realize it had been around for so long, and unfortunately they went out of business. So this project is called Big Band and Beyond. And basically it's musical portraits of these masters I got to work with. And
Amazing, yeah.
Yeah, I wrote one for Clark called Positively CT, Wayne's World for Wayne Shorter, Tall Tales for Ron Carter, A Little Bird Watching for Jimmy Heath, and then a piano concerto honoring several of the pianists I got to meet and work with. And then being named as becoming a Steinway artist, that's pretty exciting. Yeah. And then I guess winning the Charlie Parker Composition Prize for the Wayne's World, which was because I'm such a newcomer to big band writing. It's something I never thought I would be able to do. So it's just, it's wonderful and really hard at the same time to be stretched and challenged so much. But it just, you know, music is endless. And so I really appreciate every experience.
Yeah. I wonder if you have a leg up on big band writing because you didn't grow up, like John Clayton grew up in a big band. So, of course, his big band writing sounds like big band music. I wonder if...
Well, you know, it's so interesting. Yeah. Some of the musicians who have played my music, they said one of the things they like about it is that they feel that there's ample room for them to express themselves in solo. Like, it's written by someone who also plays. Mm-hmm. So that made me feel good. And I feel like I want the nimbleness of a small group, as, you know, approach to big band writing, and also just I think the sound of an orchestra is in my mind, so maybe hopefully some of that will come through too. Because I remember the first time when I was doing a residency at Western Michigan University, and we were performing one of the big band pieces, and we took a turn on a chart where I didn't expect. And I, in a small group, you can easily just say, hey, right. just do that. And I started doing that. I'm like, oh, you can't do that with 16 people. So, yeah. So I don't know. I'm curious. Maybe you can play the record on your show.
Yeah,
when it
great.
Comes out.
Sure.
You can tell me.
Yeah, I love it. Speaking of writing, we have a special co-host for this episode. This is Devin Coffer, director and violinist of Chamber Brews. Hi, Devin.
Hello. Thank you for having
Welcome
me.
Welcome in. So, Helen, we talked a lot about collaborating, mm-hmm. And we have a string player here for your upcoming collaboration. Yeah. So, I don't know, Devin, do you have a question specific?
I have so many questions. firstly, I'm a ginormous fan of the Harlem String Quartet, as I believe we all should be in this world. But what drew you to the collaboration? I knew that it was the funding came from, was it a Women Composers in New York grant? Mm-hmm. And so why, I mean, I know why the Harlem String Quartet, but why the Harlem String Quartet and why that project at that time?
I actually met them on another gig when we were both hired to play with this wonderful clarinetist, a reed player, Eddie Daniels.
Oh.
And we played, he did a collaboration with wonderful Ted Nash, one of the saxophonists in Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra. And so, you know, since I played violin too, I'm really picky about how I want the violin to sound in a jazz setting.
Thank you for that.
So I remember, you know, Regina Carter, I love her. And then when I heard them, I immediately went to them after the show. I said, would you want to collaborate one day? And they said, yes. And we had been trying for at least a few years. I applied for some grants and didn't get them. But then finally, when I got this, it was New York City Women's Fund grant, I said, we got it. So it was time to do it. And then I was like, uh-oh, now I got to write the music. But, you know, having played with them on a concert, and I knew what they were capable of. So basically, I could write anything, and I knew they'd be great, and that they were also game to improvise to, which was really exciting.
So cool. It feels like a really perfect blending of worlds, and I know what that quartet is capable of, and I feel like we really got to hear what I love so much, which is tone conversations and layering and texture and delicacy. There's just so many beautiful moments that are so special in this record that to be playing it feels like stepping into a very thoughtful world, and that it's just a delight for me to be able to do that.
That's so kind. Thank you. I mean, I love all the string instruments. I mean, I tried playing the viola when I was younger, but I always felt like my arm was about to fall off. So I stuck with the violin. And of course, everybody loves the cello, you know, mm-hmm. and just getting to use them as, you know, I tried to feature each member of the string quartet and just
yes.
really so that they could shine. And so I'm just so excited it all came together, and also really thrilled to feature music all by women, you know.
Yes.
That was something I realized. I was like, wow, when I was studying, I just never knew about this music. So that was great too. And there's so much more music that's out there to explore. So thank you for joining us.
Yes, thank you so much for having us. I genuinely cannot wait, and it's a delight. And I know that we, you know, this group has taken on jazz projects in the past that have been sort of, you know, a bird with strings sort of environment, and just to be able to step into what feels like another contemporary level democratization of the string quartet, where we really all get this chance to be featured. It's a dream. So I just appreciate it, and thank you for having us.
Well, thank you, and thank you to Jazz Arts Group for bringing me out to Columbus, where I, you know, actually lived here as a very young kid years ago when I was very, very young. Like, I was between the ages, I think, of 2 and 4. And I remember Not much, but I do remember we used our trash cans to make snowmen one winter.
A classic Columbus move.
And we went apple picking at some orchards. I remember that. Mm-hmm. And so it's always great to be back because my dad is a lifelong Buckeye fan. When those college football teams were playing, always rooting for OSU. So I'm mm-hmm. like, yay, Dad, guess where I'm going to be tomorrow?
If you don't mind, I had a question. Like, when you're writing with or for a group of people, how collaborative is that process? Or I guess in particular, this album?
This was written during the pandemic, so I wrote it.
Yeah.
I wrote it ahead of time, yeah. And then the cool thing about jazz is, you know, I'm a notorious tinkerer. You know, I'm always tinkering with my pieces, and a lot of times, the final, like I told Devin, I was like, bear with me, I gotta like update these charts because things have changed since I wrote them. You know, even at the recording, we were changing things, and then I was getting to these different opportunities, and the charts weren't updated, and I'd always have to tell the string quartet, oh, we do this now, this way. So I hope I got to everything, but if not, we'll let you know at the rehearsal.
We have all of the questions, and also I think what has been cool is that as we've taken the dive deeper into the music, we've realized that all the questions are important and also none of the questions are important. You know, we just know that when we show up, it'll get to be the experience that it is, and we'll contribute what we have, and you'll guide us along the way. So that feels special.
Well, I look forward to it.
Is there anything in particular that Chamber Brews takes on to kind of prepare yourselves for this particular music?
A lot of listening. Just entrenchment in style and form and listening. And I wouldn't say that that is so different from my personal artistic process, except to say that when I step into a jazz world, I want to do it justice. And I think I can say that. I know that sentiment is shared by the other members of my quartet. And there's fear and trepidation, but also in that work, there's freedom. And that's what I appreciate about it so much. And as a quartet that's able to step into this role or this realm, it feels powerful. And it feels like an honor and also the scariest thing I've ever done. Every time. like clockwork.
But I relate. I empathize, you know. And as I was listening to you talk, I'm reminded of something the great Kenny Barron, pianist, someone I've really looked up to. He said, for him, the difference between, one of the main differences between classical and jazz is with classical music, you perfect it in the practice room and then you go on stage. With jazz, you go on stage and that's where you perfect it. So I'm really interested in just how, when you blend these two worlds, how that dynamic works on stage. Because that's, you know, jazz music lives in the moment. It's like I always like to say, it's at that leading edge of creativity where it's a partnership with the creative spirit that we all have. It's like a collaboration at that moment, which makes it so compelling. So I'm really excited about tomorrow.
Me too. I think we can leave it there. Thank you so much, Helen, for being here. Devin, do you have any other questions?
I feel good. I'm anxious, ready to go.
Great. Well, the concert's tomorrow. If you're listening to this, you'll probably have an opportunity to watch it on JAG TV. But we're so much looking forward to hearing it. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Cheers. The Jazz Scene is presented by Jazz Arts Group of Columbus, America's oldest nonprofit organization dedicated to advancing the art of jazz. Our theme music is titled 3-4 Times by Michael Cox. This episode was produced and engineered by Mercedes Aviles. Subscribe to The Jazz Scene wherever you get your podcasts.